Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
Hi, I'm Angelique. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Angelique.
And, Why? My sobriety date is August 1st of 2007. And though technically my last drink was July 30th of 2007, but I personally, for myself, define my sobriety by an active life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so on August 1st of 2007, I walked into my first meeting. And I cried like a baby. I cried. And there were things going on in that room that I did not understand. And some of them I've come to understand have nothing really to do with AA. They have nothing really to do with the spirit of love and tolerance, the code of love and tolerance. There were some older gentlemen who were screaming at these people that were in a detox that I was not in. I just happened to walk in to this meeting, and they were screaming at them, and they were saying, "You're going to die. You're going to die." And I thought, that's scary. There are people who are going to scream at me if I let them know that I'm new. And then they said the Our Father at the end of the meeting. And I thought, I have to convert back. And I thought, even if this is a bunch of angry elderly gentlemen screaming at people, so much so that spit is flying out of their mouths, and even if I have to convert back, I'm going to do it. Because I do not know any other way. And I didn't even know what that meant. I just knew that I did not know any other way. Good news, I did not need to convert back. The freedom in AA is to really develop a God of my understanding, which was such a new concept to me, and one that I absolutely cherish. And while I'm quick to see where religious people are right, I today really believe in just about everything. And I take the good and I leave the rest. So I hope you'll do the same, because I might say something unintentionally hitting a button in you at some point. Know that it's not intentional. I am going to try to communicate in the spirit of love and tolerance. So I trust that the prayers and the intentions that I set are going to lead my voice. And hopefully something I say helps someone who needs to hear it. And it most certainly will always help me to get up here and get honest. So, but hopefully I'm not the only one. All right, so leaving aside the story of alcohol in my life before alcohol ever entered my system, there's a book that tells me that I should talk to you about that, what was going on inside of me. At the age of 5 years old, I would stand on tree stumps in the woods and explain what happens when you die to other children. I did not fit in very well. I started to learn about things like heaven in school, and it excited me very much because I did not want to be here by the age of 6 years old. So I made my first will on my first Fisher Price recorder, and I doled out my Cabbage Patch dolls to my sister, and I doled out all of my love to my grandmother, and then, in a very cruel way, I gave the tape to my mom and said, hold on to this. The letter said, hold on to this until I'm dead. This piqued her curiosity, and she played the tape, which felt like betrayal. However, then in that next hour is one of my absolute favorite memories of my whole entire lifetime, and it is this. She pulled me out into the backyard, and it was one of those beautiful, crisp days. And she, with all of her teeth showing, and that's how you could know when she really was pissed, and she's digging with this little shovel. She's digging and digging and digging, and she gets to this point in the dirt. And she holds it up, and there are some worms. And she says, you don't want to die. This is where you go when you die. I said, well, I could be a dandelion. And she said, you don't want to be a dandelion. A dandelion's a weed. And I said, but I could make people's wishes come true. And she said, it's still a weed. And I said, well, fine, then I'll be a sunflower. She kind of gave up right then. But at the same time, that's really where my head was at as a small child. My first suicide attempt, I was 11 years old, and it was after a confrontation with one of my parents. I absolutely decided that my existence was not worthwhile unless there was something, some proof of some God, some higher power. And so I gathered up all of the pills that my parents had in their medicine cabinet, and I laid them across this windowsill. And it's the first time in my life, why it's important is really because, A, it indicates my spiritual malady, and B, this was the first time in my life that I actually knelt down of my own will and said a prayer. So I lined up these pills, and then at the end of the pills, I had a cup of water, and I said, if you don't show yourself, if you don't show me that there's something, I cannot go on this way. I have a minimum of 8 years left in this house, and I will not make it. So I need to know that there's something that loves me in this world. And so waiting about 30 seconds, I popped all of these pills, and I drank that water, and I laid down on my bed, and I thought, well, this is going to be romantic. I'm just going to fall asleep. And a few moments later, I heard my mother call out all three of my names. And she wasn't as angry as she had been maybe a half an hour earlier. And so she screamed, come down here and see this. And I heard the front door. So I trudged down the stairs to walk with purpose. And I walked out the door, and I looked up, and there was this rainbow. I have never since seen a rainbow like this. This rainbow went from one side of the very tiny New Jersey sky to the other side, and it was solid color. I swore I could have taken a scoop of it and eaten it. It was that thick. And my next thought was, I think there are children present, so I'll change that a little. Oh, no, was my next thought. And so here are the real miracles that happened for that night. For the first time and the last time in my mother's drinking history, she emptied out a glass of wine that she had already started drinking. Then she made a pot of coffee. And then she made me dinner, even though my dad was out of town. Then she calmly sat with me, and we went over the homework. This whole thing was over a grade. So that had never happened, and it never happened again in the time that my mother was drinking. So it was a pretty explosive night. I knew that there was something even capable of working through her. So that was pretty incredible. Moving on. You know, my first drink I don't really remember too much of because I was around the ages of 5 or 6. A screwdriver was slipped in the back door by the bad kid in the neighborhood. I remember falling asleep promptly after drinking this thing quickly. However, my first drunk is a great example of the kind of people that I attract when I'm drinking. So I'm 14 years old, and it's the 80s, and my hair is big, and I'm wearing all white. And I'm being fixed up with this boy. And I'm in a town that is known as the Bad Town. And I'm not supposed to go to the Bad Town or hang out with the bad kids. So I'm with the bad kids in the Bad Town drinking Canadian whiskey. And I was not at that point in time able to, you know, I didn't chug the bottle and this turns into a wild night. Instead, the person that they fix me up with is the head of a satanic cult, who is actually quite cute, but still, we have some issues with our standards. That didn't stop me. I dated him for a little while, and until he went away to his aunt's house, which was actually rehab for crack. By hanging out with these people, my eyes were opened very quickly toward a whole entire world that I was very naive toward. So things were changing very quickly. Even that night, they said we were stopping at 7-Eleven. Now we're in Camden. Then there's a junkie with white stuff on his lips, and he's asking us for $5, and then there's a man with a gun up to his head. I mean, things just went quickly, very, very fast. And I already was getting a semi-adult education at home. So. That night, I threw myself in the middle of a road, hoping to be run over by traffic. I am not the person who drank and all of a sudden was like, relief! I'm a part of. It just didn't happen for me, and yet I continued to drink for 16 years. The progression went on and on and on, and I personally rarely felt the sensation of relief ever. I am the depressive who loves reading things like, we could write a whole book about these people. But what I wanted to be was normal. My whole life, I just wanted to be normal. And normal to me meant anybody but me. That's just what that meant. So I would really try. I would try your personality on and her personality on. I would try everybody else's personality on just to try to fit into whatever this normal was. It just didn't work out for me. By the time I was in high school, and I'm only talking about all this early stuff simply because we do have some serious time to fill here. We're getting to it. So... very early on in high school, even when I wasn't, you know, I wasn't drinking, I wasn't taking substances, I was somebody who wore headphones all the time because I couldn't hear people laughing behind me. If I heard people laughing behind me, I thought to myself, why are they laughing at me? Why am I so ugly and horrific? How do they know how stupid I am that they're laughing at me and I'm not even talking to them? That was the level of self-esteem that I had, like a dead rock level. So, and yet I was somebody who could show up. I was somebody who could put on a marvelous mask and show you the person that I thought you wanted to see, which actually, it did actually turn out pretty well. I showed up pretty confidently. I wasn't the greatest student, though. I know a lot of alcoholics are like the greatest students ever and sports and all this. That was not my bag. I was into the arts. And I was really just kind of quite lost inside my own head. And I didn't realize that that's like the disease of alcoholism beyond the whole one of the symptoms being alcohol is that I just think about myself nonstop. I had no idea that my bad confidence or my bad self-esteem was sickness or selfishness. And I hear people in the rooms, you know, telling other people, well, it's just because you're a selfish SOB, blah, blah, blah. It's a really painful disease. It is excruciating that I think about myself as much as I think about myself. Without any form of maintenance, I would not have survived. Just this alone. This. So, and I never was able to get enough money together to really drink the way that I wanted to, even as I progressed. So, apparently there was a God looking after me then too. You know, to fast forward to some degree, because there's actually... because it's actually 8:22. Holy Jesus. All right. So, through college, I moved out of my parents' house, and I quickly got myself a drug addict boyfriend. He was someone to take care of. I was used to taking care of people. I was used to watching after them, and I enjoyed someone else making me look better. However, every single time I drank, I was not good at it, and I was certain that it was my age or lack of practice. So every time I drank, I would puke on your shoes or your prized possession. I would fall into bushes. People had to carry me home. I was the party foul and the lightweight. But I continued to drink. I decided when I graduated from college that the real problem in my life was the people that surrounded me, my parents definitely, and I am not here to tell you that I got sober, went through the steps, and that there haven't been some serious problems and sickness in my family. But I am here to promise you that we get well, they might not, and it becomes okay. So, graduated college, and I thought, all right, well, what can I do to break free of all of this? Now I'm starting to drink almost on a nightly basis. So I decide the best thing for me is distance. So I moved to Japan. I really believe that the further I got was the better I would be. It's pretty far. I was the tallest woman in the nation of Japan. They have beer vending machines next to hot corn soup and porn vending machines. It's a different world. While I lived there, I made some goals for myself, and they were I was not going to date anyone. I wasn't going to get into any relationships. I was going to be celibate for a year. So I met the next guy that I went out with in the airport when I landed. And he was this super beautiful, tall, mid-East guy, and he was smart. And I always thought if I surrounded myself with people that had what I wanted, I would be able to absorb it through osmosis without doing anything that they do. So we went out for a while, and, you know, the most important thing in that relationship is that at a certain point he said, you know, can't you not drink? Could you not drink? And I wasn't drinking all that much at that point, just like one bottle of wine for dinner. And so I thought, well, that's rude. So I'm going to drink before we meet up and not tell you. But what I started to discover at that point in time was that when I do that, when I put alcohol in my system and then I stop drinking, that my skin becomes very tight. And whoever I am with that I perceive as the obstacle to that drink, I no longer like them very much. They actually become a source of irritation. And so I still continued on in a relationship with that guy for a year and a half. And when I left Japan, I moved to West Philadelphia, which was a great contrast. Now I'm kicking crack addicts off my porch and dodging bullets in my own kitchen. It was a very interesting year. I was certain that Philadelphia was the problem in my life. And I just needed to go back to school because when I'm in school, I have an institution. When I have an institution telling me that I'm good enough, I can work hard enough and I can fit in and I can be something close to normal. So I applied to one grad school, I made it in, and I moved to New York City. And it was a 3-year program. The rules of drinking started to change because what was unclassy in New Jersey to drink during the day was very classy in New York. It's called brunch, and it can just last all day long. I, as an artist, I also had certain permissions with substances and alcohol and the whole entire thing. However, I will tell you that at the end of that 3-year period, within 2 weeks of graduating from grad school and having a master's degree and really finally being smart, I was homeless on the streets of New York City. And that lasted for the next 2.5 years. I drank my rent. I drank my way out of employment. I decided with the degree I should probably pick up bartending. And so it goes. There is nothing that introduced me to shame, guilt, and degradation quicker than not having a roof over my head and having to find ways to not have to sleep on the sidewalk. Because the things that happen to women that sleep on the sidewalk in New York City, many do not survive at all. So instead, I had a walk of shame that I pretty much did every single day and was not bumping into the nicest of social circles at this point in time. So it was rough. However, it wasn't my bottom. It wasn't anywhere close to it. What I have learned is that a bottom has nothing to do with objects or things or stuff. It doesn't have anything to do with that at all. For me, you know, and I'm sure that's different for everybody, but for me, it really had to do with just getting to a place where I looked in the mirror at one point when I could force myself to look in the mirror, and I couldn't recognize myself at all. And I could see that there was very little soul in my eyes. And that didn't necessarily stop me. I think I still kept going for about a year after that. So in that time period, I got into another relationship. And it was actually the first relationship that I was in since the guy from Japan. And this guy was going to keep me safe because he was a Brooklyn-born, covered-in-tattoos hitman. And, of course, that's the safest place to put yourself. So because he was capable of punching people in one punch and they would fall over, I thought this equaled safety. You are catching on to the mental insanity here, right? So we were together for about a year and a half, and at least I had a place to stay. And he was a methadone addict, 17 years of methadone. And things got really ugly, and I was just as ugly. I absolutely, totally understand 100% that I was just as ugly in that relationship and just as abusive. I just wasn't the person with the muscles. So there were two occasions in which this person tried to strangle me to death. And waking up from that with a necklace made of bruises did not stop me. For whatever reason, common logic went out the window, and I became incapable of distinguishing between the true and the false. So, at a certain point, though, he broke all of our recycling on the kitchen floor, and that woke me up for whatever reason. That was a lot of glass. So, on that specific day, I said, I gotta get out of here. Because the problem is probably New York. So I moved to New Jersey, and I hadn't spoken to my parents in what I thought was a very long time. And I called my dad that day, and I said, hey, Dad, sorry you haven't heard from me in so long. And he started to cry, and he's not an emotionally expressive guy. Just imagine like a 1950s beef-eating Republican German. He's not emotionally expressive, not in touch with his emotions. So he started to cry, and he said, you call me almost every night, and you leave me messages, and you cry for help, and I don't have a number to call you back. And I'm thinking I hadn't spoken to this person in maybe a year. And I'm realizing how bad my blackouts were at that point. And I went home, and I thought, you know, since the problem was New York, I should probably just really cut back. So I was staying with my parents, which was very gracious of them to give me a place to stay. It was a very interesting time. For the next 6 months, I continued to drink. My dad thought, if we buy her a car and she pays us back slowly, everything will get better. God bless him. So he bought me a car. My brother's a car salesman out in Texas. I flew out to Texas to pick up this car, And that day I had to wait to pick it up. I was supposed to pick it up in the morning, and then I got a call that I had to wait until the evening, which meant I needed to stay sober all day long. So I went out to this pool, and I start floating in this pool, and all this pain is just combusting. I feel like I'm being ripped open, and my skin is just raw. And so I'm laying in this pool, and I'm floating, and I shouted up at the Texas sky, "Help me." And I didn't know that was a prayer, but that was a prayer, and it was a good enough prayer. And I started to feel something, the presence of something, and I did not think that any presence would be showing up for me in my life again. But I felt that, and I felt that I did not want to drink. So I went out that night, and I had 17 margaritas, because that scared me to death. I didn't black out, though, and that was really strange. Over those next few days, I drove the car back, and I just had my one or two bourbons to get me by. And I got back into the area, and really, this one, it's the last of the drunkalogue, folks, and it's also my first step. And it is that I walked into this bar, and I said to myself, I could have three bourbons, three beers, and then I'll be fine to drive. As soon as I took a sip, the next thought in my head was, I could probably do four of these. And I started to negotiate, maybe just two beers and four of these. I blacked out at that moment, and I came out of the blackout as I was walking out of the bar. When I was walking into that bar, one of my longtime bartenders was unwrapping that bottle. When I was leaving the bar, he was handing me a shot, and I said, no, it's good. And he said, no, you finished the whole bottle. You might as well just take this last bit. Now, there are some nights when I would have three wines and be caked. Do you know what I mean? Hormones in a woman, drinking as a woman is it's a different thing. I understand we're all alcoholics, but there are times when I didn't have to have a lot of alcohol in order to be out of my mind. So I don't know how my body fit that much into my system. I walked out of there and I got behind the wheel of a car. I pulled over on the side of the road to tell my friend something very important, which to this day I couldn't even pronounce. Sirens show up behind me. That's all I remember of that moment, except for this blip in the conversation where the police officer says, "Where did you get the Texas tags from?" And I said, "I just got back from Virginia." At the time, I'm 195 pounds. I'm kind of yellow, and I reek like bourbon. And I don't mean the drinking bourbon. I mean the coming through your flesh, that detoxing wild flavor. So there was I didn't cute my way out of that ticket. I do not know how and there's no other explanation other than a God that is more powerful than a DUI. So, and I needed that car to be able to drive newcomers around. That's pretty much the way I ended up reasoning it to myself. That next day, I ended up laying in bed and feeling ashamed and feeling scared. And it's somewhere in there, I had told my parents off when I got home because they were the reason I was drunk like this, even though they had not had a drink at that point in 12 years. Not through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just in a different way. And there are different strokes for different folks. So I walked into that day, right? So I'm laying in bed, and in the middle of the day, I snuck out when nobody was home to see if there was any blood on my bumper. And there was no blood on my bumper. But I still thought, I really don't know what happened, though. And I'm not, having no blood there does not convince me that I didn't do something absurd. So then I called my friend Michael, and I said, you know what? If you thought you might have a problem with alcohol, what would you do? Now, he at that point was 16 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he said, well, I would go to as many meetings, AA meetings a week as I drank. How many days a week did you drink? And I said, well, three or four. And he said, okay, well, you pretend you drank seven and go to seven meetings a week. So he also told me to find this woman, Shara, And I really thought, well, what do I need that for? He said, just find this woman, Shara. She has something you want. And so at the second meeting I ever went to, Shara was there. And at the third meeting and at the fourth meeting, all of a sudden she was just everywhere. So she is my sponsor to this day. We've been working together for the past 7 years. And I get a lot out of that relationship. And there are still things that I want from her. And there are still suggestions that I try to get out of. That definitely happens. But I'm finally conceding on one that she's been trying to give to me for 5 years. So what happened for me is that I hemmed and hawed in those first 90 days, and I felt like somebody was secretly ripping my skin off, that the nerves had come out of the edges of my skin, and I was riding on a razor blade roller coaster. That is exactly how I felt in early sobriety. It was the most painful time of my life. And they told me I would never have to feel that way again, and damned if I'm not. One of the fears that I am totally okay with having is that I don't ever want to feel that way again. But there's another side to it. And there have been times in Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm doing the best that I can, but still a little bit lost, and have wanted to kill myself in AA. But it has been a very long time since I have had a desire to pick up a drink. And when those feelings have come upon me, I know to reach out to people. And I have gone through a decent amount of infancy and immaturity in AA, thinking, well, you get to this year and you don't need help anymore. You get to that year and you feel good all the time. You're just happy. But the 10-step actually tells me when I feel irritated. It doesn't say if, it says when. So very tricky, those writers of our literature. So at 3 months, I went to my sponsor and I started to complain because there was a guy who was sponsoring a girl, but they were also sleeping next to each other, based also on that osmosis theory. Mm-hmm. And that irritated me. The girl was 16. The guy was in his 20s. That's me justifying. I went to my sponsor, though, and she said, are you here to complain? And I said, well, it's totally inappropriate. And she said, okay, well, how about this? Look around our home group. And at that point, we're standing in the Cherry Hill Young People's, and at that point, it was actually in Cherry Hill. And there are 100 people in this room, and probably about 50 of them are women. And she says, how many women do you think are sponsors in this room? And I said, well, probably, like, if there are 50, probably maybe 45. And she said, no, See that girl, Colleen, over there? Her and me, we're the sponsors here in this room, and we're overwhelmed, and we can't help all of these girls because this isn't Codependent Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and we need strong women to be able to bring these women through these steps in an honest way. Are you going to be that woman, or are you going to be the complainer? Because if you got to complain, you got to go to somebody else. I was like, well, shit. But you know what I discovered in that moment, what she told me, which was the most important thing that I've ever heard? I had a purpose. I actually had a purpose. Like, I was capable of it. She was trying to say that I could become one of those strong women who could help another woman to not feel so ashamed anymore, simply by helping her to have the steps. And those steps were going to place a God of her understanding in her life, which were going to give her the necessary power to not have to pick up a drink. I did. I got kissed. So, first time in a long time. So, I'm somebody who likes to do things to the extreme. Not sure if you can relate to that. So, I went through the steps, because I started sponsoring around 8 months, and some people were up in arms about that. You have to have a year. Bill and Bob didn't have a year. We'd all be dead if they waited. So I started sponsoring pretty early on, but I also knew that I didn't really know anything. I knew that I had had a spiritual experience. I knew that I had had a spiritual awakening, because all of a sudden I wanted to help people. And that's awake. But at the same time, I knew that I still was full of fear and that I still had just so much stuff. So I decided to go through on a semi-annual house cleaning, which some of us do. So I did that for 4.5 years. So after 10 rounds of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I decided perhaps I overdid things, and maybe I was putting off some of the maintenance steps on a regular basis, counting on being able to have a fourth step every 6 months, which was causing some issues for me. Also, early on, I saw the word meditation all over the place, and I see it all over the big book, and long before the 11th step, I see it. Sit quietly, pray, and then sit quietly, all of this sitting quietly. So I got a meditation teacher. I started studying with a Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he started to teach me meditation, and he started to teach me restraint, and I'm living in a home with my mother, and she is telling me that I am fat and ugly every day, and she is telling me that I am worthless and that no one will ever love me, and I am able to restrain myself for the first time in my life and not fight back. That's incredible. And in the times when I did, argue back, which I always ended up regretting because anger is the number one poison for me, I learned that lesson for myself, that I needed to either make a choice. I needed to walk away or be able to stay and restrain myself. You know, and over time, I've learned so many other tools. My parents aren't all that well still. I have been able to develop a relationship with both of them. Which has been pretty incredible, and boundaries, love and tolerance. That word is so beautiful. So, studying meditation really started to change my experience of the steps. It really deepened things. And there are some people that have walked up to me in the rooms of AA. Perhaps they're in their immature phase, and have said, I just can't relate to you anymore because you just don't have any problems, which is not true. It's just I'm kind of calm about even having problems today. Alcoholics Anonymous for me and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not about maintaining my happiness. And a year ago, I would have told you it is about maintaining my happiness. Because I believe that when I'm happy, I'm more useful. I've discovered over this past summer that that's not always actually true. And while it's not about the intentional manufacture of misery, I have to be human. I just have to be human. And when I'm pissed, I have to be pissed. And that doesn't mean making a decision or taking an action based on that feeling. But those feelings are real, they are human, and they still exist in me at various points. So then I still use the principles of, let's say, like reach out to a sponsor, talk to them, other alcoholics. Of course, always reach out to God first. You know, and the process of inventorying, of looking at these things as they come up. I have watched three of my very dear friends this year, two of which had 25 years, one had 32 years, and they are drunk today. Because they got too much damn time to do any of the step work. They had given enough service. These are all things that they had said. I've seen, you know, and I've had the opportunity to go to a number of AA funerals. One woman that I had the pleasure of sponsoring for 16 months, her family wasn't on her fourth step. I'm just going to say that's a clue that it might not be thorough. Not that everybody has the same problems, but you love them the most. Of course you hate them the most. So there's nothing I could do to make her more honest. And what ended up happening there is that she went out to make an amends to somebody. She picked up one pill and she dropped dead. And and as her husband says, her suffering was given an opportunity to end. And for me, I had to learn that I am not an AA superhero. I am not here to save other alcoholics because they are beyond human aid, just like me. I finally had to have a funeral service for my hero cape. It was very cute. I dug a hole in my front yard. I made a fake cape, but it was, you know, it's like a God box. I really needed to let it go. So, I don't know, this past summer, I will tell you that I got into some work, you know, it talks about in the 11th step how there are treasure troves or library. I'm not a great quoter, but essentially that there's a lot of material out there for us to grow in our conscious contact with a God of our understanding. And so I was going through this process, which is a lot like, because spiritual principles are all the same in whatever book you read. At least that's what I've found of the ones that I've read. They're all the same. They're just in different words. So I was going through this really heavy, like, 6 and 7 process, basically, and I was letting go of lack at the deepest levels. Like, and oh my God, this summer kicked my ass, something fierce. It was a really incredible summer. However, here's the really amazing thing. You know, when I was younger, I never wanted to feel the things that I felt. And I was certain that I was always going to have to put something from the outside world in me in order to feel better. However, I was able to go through months of feeling horrible, still praying, meditating, going to meetings, sponsoring women, showing up, doing service commitments. And I mean, I thought I was in hell. There are periods of time in which I just wanted to start, I don't know, kicking my own ass or beating myself. You know what I mean? And I'm sure on an emotional scale, I was doing some of that. But I really had to grow the hell up when it came to some idea of better than, you know, that gets embedded in this spiritual process that is just not healthy for me. Who knew that was going to come out? So in the meantime, my home groups, which I didn't mention, are the Cherry Hill Young People's, which meets Wednesday nights in Haddonfield. We got kicked out of our church because we threw cigarette butts in the parking lot. Wink, wink, ashtrays. the Monday night Big Book Women's Study of Haddon Heights, which is a really incredible meeting I've been going to since I had, since way early on. Those women have really raised me in AA. And if you don't have a circle of really tight women that totally call you on your stuff, get some. Oh my God. What a relief to have people really care about you enough to say, knock it the shit off, Angelique. oh God. And then there's Inner Vision for You, which is Inner Vision for You is an AA meditation meeting, which got started about 4 years ago after I studied with the Dalai Lama. And I came back from that class. I did a 7-day class with him, and then I came back and people were saying, it looks like meditation is really doing something for you. And in our region, nobody was really getting into, people were calling like just gardening meditation, but we live with four seasons. So they could only really garden during spring and summer. So a lot, and I know that, I don't know, each to their own. However, the whole sit quietly thing, it's a recurrent message. And I've just found for myself, when it talks about, and I don't know where this is or in which book, but when it talks about finding an adequate replacement, while alcohol and booze was not super fun for me, and it certainly wasn't fun for anybody who was in my association at that time, there are certain other substances that were incredible, absolutely incredible. I would not touch them today. I do not touch them today, and my sobriety is my sobriety. However, when they talk about finding an adequate replacement, I have found that in meditation. So, and it's surprising to sit with myself, someone that I loathed so much, I think it's one of the most courageous acts a person can take, to sit with yourself when you hate yourself, to be in your own company and then invite, you know, at first this mystical, magical, what is this God thing going on? But over the years, it's something that's really developed, so much so that I actually became a meditation teacher and a shaman. Became a Reiki master. So I teach people about spirituality, non-alcoholics. I'm a spiritual counselor. I'll be a minister next year, which is kind of wild. I also am a teacher in a university where I teach communication and public speaking. So that's pretty much how I'm keeping myself busy. But at the end of the day, none of that stuff means anything without the ability to connect to that God of my understanding. And I am not somebody who can go a day. I'm not even somebody who can just do something in the morning and then like hope that carries me through. I'm a constant contact kind of a gal. That is also the name of my fourth and final home group, Conscious Contact for You, which meets on Sundays, which is also an AA meditation meeting. So, I don't know. As for myself, dear God, I have no idea if what I said to you made sense or was linear. I think this is the most jumbled talk I think I've ever given, and I'm totally okay with that. Somebody must have gotten something out of this, right? So in the meantime, you know, I got $167,000 in debt. Oh, well, I'm paying it off. I have a broken tooth, and I need to make it to a dentist, and I'll get there. I have a kind of peace in me that I just never knew. I never knew it as a child. I never knew it as a teenager. I didn't know it in my 20s, and I get to know it closer to 40 now. The bourbon works as a preservative. But it has a cutoff timer, and I don't know when that is, so I'm really glad I stopped when I did. What I have today is just irreplaceable, and it's not something that I gave to myself. And yet, the kind of will that it takes to join this thing and to just keep showing up when 1,000 thoughts to one are telling me, I don't feel like it. I don't feel like it. I don't feel like it. But on the days when I don't feel like it, there's something that's just not quite right when I listen to that voice. When I just ask, what would you have me be? Not what would you have me do? What would you have me be? All of a sudden, I get flooded with a kind of inspiration that I'm apt to take credit for. If I'm not surrounded with people like yourselves who remind me on a consistent basis that we're inspired people so long as we ask for it. Most recently, I've had the opportunity to work with this new sponsee who went through, she went through the process of the steps before, and her first sponsor never told her about prayer, never told her about meditation. Now, yes, it's in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so easy to miss all those prayers. Oh my God, there's no way I would be able to pick up anything if I hadn't read that with another person. Now, I know that there are workbooks, and I know that there is the 12 and 12. Those are all fine, too. I don't really have a judgment or a care how somebody has a spiritual awakening. I just know for myself, my own experience, that that book unlocked something and that it continues to, more continues to be revealed on a very regular basis. So what I've been discovering in this experience with this lady is that just by having the guts and the courage to talk to somebody about prayer, something so sensitive as that, and not telling her what her God should be or anything like that, but that she needs one. She needs to have an understanding of some kind of higher power. And to talk to her about these very personal things that sometimes can be rife with controversy. And I've had a number of people tell me, like, you just talk too much about God. You're scaring them. But I'm willing to have an honest conversation with people, and I if somebody tells me they're an atheist, I'm just as cool to talk to them. Like, I don't have any biases. That's the whole deal, isn't it? To be able to have open and honest conversations. If the people who call me on my stuff didn't call me on my stuff, I would not be here. And not call me on my stuff like from some sort of hilltop or position of power. But from like, hey, man, you suffer from this thing I suffer from, and I can help you. And once upon a time, all I did was say, help me, out loud. And 6 days later, I was sober. And I don't know how the flip else that happens. And so this, I'm watching this woman right now, and it's like the highlight of an experience, to watch someone start to develop that relationship, not ask you all the minute details of what they should be doing with their lives. But just reach out for that thing and then call me and say, I'm ready for this next step. Oh my God, how much easier sponsorship is now that I have no hero cape. And this girl got to call me the other night and say, I went to dinner at my parents' house and we had a beautiful time and we were having a conversation and I wasn't scared and I wasn't sitting there thinking about what they might be thinking about me. And I didn't even notice the time and I was able to stay. And we laughed and laughed and laughed and then I went on my separate way and here I am calling you and I'm up 3 hours later than I normally would be. That's an amazing, I can't even tell you, like, of all the things that I've experienced in my lifetime, watching the light turn on for somebody else is an incredible experience. I will let you know, though, that after years of setting boundaries and setting them with love and cleaning my side of the street and all of this stuff, my mother came to me last week and asked me if I would teach her how to meditate. And regardless of the fact that she suffers with dry alcoholism, which is something that I can clearly see, her suffer with, the kind of fear that wraps her up on a daily basis. I was so damn excited for her that she was going to get some peace, not because she would all of a sudden turn into a nice person. It's probably not gonna happen. It's okay. She's full of fear. When we're full of fear, we're selfish. End of story. We all experience it. But alcoholics can't afford it. My mother came to my house and took a meditation seminar. And after telling me that my feng shui romance corner was off in the middle of one of our attempts, and in the middle of the second attempt telling me my job wasn't good enough, I was able to open my eyes each time and say, I know you use me to distract you from you. And I have sympathy for that. But I don't want to be your tool of destruction. I want you to get peace if that's what you want for yourself. And then she made a double attempt and she sat for 15 straight minutes. You have no idea. That was amazing. Because she left my house calmer than she had ever been. And in that next 2.5 hours, she gave me a kind of fourth step. And I was able to throw mustard seeds of accountability. Without being, you know, rough. I'm not her sponsor. The idea that I can be present for people without wanting them to be somebody other than they are is an indicator that I'm finally okay with being my own imperfect, ridiculous, sometimes nonsensical, an absolutely beautiful child of God. And I know that that's true about every single person in this room. So I thank you for listening to me tonight. And have a good night.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.